The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. As we begin the year with a lot of interviews, and I'd hope to have a recent interview with an author for you on the program today, but unfortunately, the fire in Los Angeles was getting very close to his house this week as we were getting ready to record the show, and he had to flee, so we don't have that interview with this very well-known Los Angeles writer, and we'll try to reschedule that at another time. In the meantime, we're going to go back to 1999. 26 years ago, I did my only interview with a poet named Dick Lurie. He was a poet and a musician. He was known as a saxophonist, and he loved playing the blues, and his poetry is very topical. And 25 years ago, when I talked to him, I found some of the things he had to say somewhat shocking. So prepare for some shocking radio. We had to actually cut out some of the poems that he read that day because they had bad words in them. But we bleeped them back then, and we totally bleeped them this time because we're not going to even run them. But we did choose some poems that he gets on political topics, and they're funny, and they might be somewhat shocking to some listeners. Here's Dick Lurie with Ghost Radio, going back to 1999. We call it the best of the Book Nook.
Dick Lurie has joined us, and his latest collection of poems is called Ghost Radio. Rather than ask you questions about the blues, how about if we hear a poem about it?
Sure. It's called Questions About the Blues. Shall we go out and hear some music? I say to my wife, there's a blues band tonight at Johnny D's, to which her unfailing reply is, a black band or a white band? This is the wrong question, of course, but not that far wrong. My wife, as a student at the University of Chicago, went to the Southside clubs, heard Magic Sam, Junior Wells, Muddy Waters in their prime. And I could say, what about the others? Charlie Musselwhite, Elvin Bishop, the white exceptions. But that just proves the rule. Her question's wrong because the point's not if they're black, they're probably good musicians, or they invented blues so they hold the copyright. But I'm not sure there is a right question. And in any case, my wife is entitled to her own precautions. She's like someone with a taste for great wine. And just so I won't waste her evening, she wants to know if what I'm offering her is a bottle of Sneaky Pete in a paper bag. I was at a panel discussion once at a blues festival in Clarksdale, and the panel discussion was entitled, Should White People Play the Blues? Which didn't seem to be a very useful question. I mean, it was sort of an interesting general area, but how do you answer that question? But, you know, it was really a sort of an exploration of the relations between the races as played out in on this field of music, which, you know, is very rooted in the black community, yet which is shared by a whole lot of other people who are not necessarily black. And it's true. This is what my wife says to me. She says, well, are we going to hear a black band or a white band? And I think to myself, you shouldn't be asking that question. That's not the right thing to ask when you're going to hear the blues. But, you know, there's something in what she says that you have to pay attention to, even though it's not quite the right question. Does your audience know about Lee Atwater, you think?
I think they probably remember him.
Remember Lee Atwater, the guy who invented the Willie Horton poster and various other depredations. Who was a puzzling figure because he really did seem to love the music. He's a white Southerner who played the guitar, and but he did these terrible racist things during his political campaign, through his political life. So it's a funny, contradictory life that he lived. Anyway, here's the poem, and it's called Portrait. It's in two parts. The poem is called Portrait in Rhythm and Blues. One, former National Republican Party Chairman Lee Atwater had many opportunities to integrate his love for black music with his career in politics. For example, when he was Bush's campaign manager, it was his feeling for those people and their music that suggested to him how the photo of a black man's face could be used to influence what white voters did. Likewise, the sweet soul music featured at inauguration festivities, few other strategists would have understood how to offset any previous damage by framing an appeal to the older middle-class blacks, not as blacks, but as fellow members of the middle class. And then, a masterstroke, the chairman of the Republican Party as Howard University trustee. In my mind's eye, Lee Atwater pulls up in a pink Cadillac for his first board meeting. Rings flash on his hands. He's in a gold sequined suit. A sharp valet carries his guitar. "Dig it, brothers," he says. "I'm your soul man." But it didn't work out. Some students claimed he didn't respect them or their music. They doubted his sincerity so much that he was forced to retire from the board, disappointed and with his feelings hurt. Two. Then Lee Atwater died of brain cancer. So if I wasn't respectful of the dead, I'd make some joke about how his thinking had been sick for a long time anyway, and so forth. But I won't do that. Instead, I'll give him credit for his letters of regret to Dukakis and others, though he still didn't repudiate the man his slime bucket cleverness helped elect. My naturally generous nature will let that pass. I'll even credit him with really liking the music, which makes his betrayal of it all the more unforgivable. And I know that if there are private hells for those who deserve them, there's a special one for Lee Atwater. They've given him an office, but there are no phones, no campaign to run, no one to manipulate. There are no inaugural balls where soul music can be made to lick the presidential shoes. Instead, through all eternity, Lee Atwater sits behind a big desk listening to Pat Boone's greatest hits.
Sounds like hell to me.
Yeah. Sounds like it to me. I was trying to. That was a hard poem to write. That's one of the more difficult poems because the, you're trying to attack this guy, who is such an obvious target, and you know you don't want to just be hitting it over the head, you know, and make it too obvious. But you know the anger has to get through, and on the other hand, if it's nothing but, like we were talking about before, if it's nothing but expression of anger, you know, hit him over the head, that's not really a poem, that's hitting over the head. So this was a tough one to do.
I get the impression from reading the book, you were planning on writing poems for all the presidents, but you had to kind of skip ahead because Bill Clinton just really got your attention.
That's true. I had to skip one. I think I went out of order there.
Yeah, there's a bad word in that poem, Rest Easy, Bill Clinton, but what's the thing with Bill Clinton? What really irks you about him?
A number of things. The poem that I wrote about him was quite a long time ago, so it wasn't any about recent scandals, but I mean, what irks me about him is that he pretends to be something of a liberal and a leftist, and he's really not much of a leftist and not much of a liberal for my money. There are people who are a lot worse on issues of racism than he is, but Well, that's about all I can say. I mean, I think he's just, he just has not had a really solid policy on a lot of things. I mean, his foreign policy has been a disaster, I think, as we're seeing. His domestic policy, you know, I think he had some chances very early to do things like improve medical care in this country, and he blew that opportunity. And then, you know, to get involved in these, you know, this sex scandal stuff, and you know, this is when, you know, when Clinton and the Congress were all involved in this sex scandal affair last year. This is when they should have been paying attention to what's going on in the Balkans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's too late. Well, it's not too late, but I mean, there's an awful lot of terrible things that could have been avoided if they'd been paying attention.
You draw attention in your poems to a number of racist situations. Also, you point in a number of poems to the gay issue in America. In fact, that particular poem, you start off with a quote from Mark Twain, quote, "Patriotism and gay bashing are the last refuge of the scoundrel." I'm trying to remember what book that was in, but
well, if I have to admit it, I'm not sure that Mark Twain included gay bashing in his original quote, but I thought that he certainly would have if he had thought of it.
It's very clever.
I think that the patriotism quote, I think, I don't think it was a book. I think it was something that he said somewhere. You know, and I think it was as part of a speech, or I believe he was probably talking about the Spanish-American War.
I was reading in the paper this morning here in Ohio that up in northern Ohio in Cleveland, there was another demonstration at the ballpark over the name of the team up there.
This is
something that you have an interest in as well.
Yeah, I do. I do. I actually have this poem about it. Should we read that one?
I think, if I remember correctly, I think that one's okay.
Well,
I'm not saying your poems are obscene. You just you occasionally throw in a word for effect that if Nixon said it, it would say expletive deleted.
Right. That's right.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think this one has any of those. Anyway, this is exactly about that issue that you're raising. And this does, a technique that, I think that poets do sometimes and that I do sometimes, which is you take an actual situation and you extrapolate from it to try to think about what it would be like if you pushed the situation even further.
In other words, Dick, that's a disclaimer that this is not meant to offend anyone.
Ah, no, quite the opposite. It's not meant to offend. It's meant to awaken an alarm.
Okay,
Dick. Let's say that. It's called Team Sports. When the 1995 World Series pitted Braves against Indians, the great excitement of Native Americans at the kind of respect they were getting through nationwide TV images of their cultures, big chiefs, feathers, tomahawks, soon led other ethnic groups to wonder if they should be expecting the same. And sure enough, within a few more seasons, the Washington Greasy Guinea Wops faced the Green Bay Kikes with their mascot, Jew Boy, who does the comic Yiddish accent wrapped in a green and gold prayer shawl, which he dips into the Gatorade for laughs, wailing, "Oy veyis mir," after every touchdown.
Now,
I thought that was a sufficiently unpleasant picture that it might make people think about, you know.
Do you come from a Jewish background?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I'm Jewish.
So you're entitled to do that just by dint of your background, right?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to know what entitled means.
I'm trying to be facetious, Dick. My guest is Dick Lurie. The book is Ghost Radio. And I remember very well Dick Nixon running for president back in 1960. In 1962, when he lost the California gubernatorial race, his famous quote, "You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore."
Right.
And then 6 years later, there he was with his very close victory over Hubert Humphrey in 72, a big landslide over McGovern. And frankly, he's not around to kick around anymore. But on the event of his death, I know a lot of folks, whether they loved him or hated him, really felt a sense of loss. And I know you're one of those.
Yeah, that's right. And I wrote these two poems here called Two Sonnets on the Death of Richard Nixon. One, "Now Hitler," they said, "Hitler's foreign policy was, yes, seriously flawed, even disastrous. And his treatment of the Jews, the gypsies, the queers, the others, was certainly controversial. But as for his domestic policy, let's not forget that he made the German people for quite some time feel good about themselves. And as his Secretary of State said at the funeral, he shaped the course of the world. And as others said, he was a towering intellect. He never gave up. And as Billy Graham said, we will meet him again in heaven when we die. Two, I always knew who Richard Nixon was, and he never knew who I was. Suppose it were the other way around. He knew me and then I died. What would he say? Let me say this about that. He'd say, this man started as a communist dupe or worse, expressed his lack of patriotism during the war in Vietnam, didn't stop being a radical till he died. Short shrift is what I would get from Nixon. And I'll give the same. War criminal, cheap crook, sleaze master, weasel scumbag of politics. Funeral speeches could not erase this. Nixon's place in history is assured.
Whoa. I see our phone lines lighting up here.
I may say that I was not requested to read that on President's Day. I'm not sure why. I got to thinking, well, suppose there were musicians who really, like me, really like the kind of music they play, and suppose there were other musicians who really love their instrument. You know, it'd be like two different ways of looking at the world. This is where the poem came from. So it's called, actually, I realized later that the poem probably should have been called The Tenor Sax or The Brooklyn Dodgers. So here it is. To me, the music's more important than my instrument. Let me have R&B, soul, blues. I'd give up the sax, learn guitar, anything, so I could play what I love. But I know others whose passion for flute, violin, trumpet would make them beg you for any kind of music. Just let them play it on the instruments they cherish. So different from my way of seeing things. Though it's true, I did look at baseball that way when the Dodgers, instrument of my passion, left Brooklyn. I lost all of my interest in the game. So I can't say my approach to life has been consistent. As for love, I viewed it more like music than baseball. Knowing exactly what I wanted to hear and switching instruments whenever they weren't producing the right sound, which, of course, was just in my head. After all those years playing out of tune, what I needed instead was the Dodgers. And finding you was like walking into Ebbets Field. Love is baseball to me now. Always getting it right doesn't matter, so long as I don't have to give you up. And I love you, my sweet Campanella.
And he was a heck of a hitter, wasn't he?
Yeah, Roy Campanella is one of the great guys.
And that car wreck really did him in.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing that one of the more recent poems in the book, Dick, is a poem that is one of my favorites. I read it earlier today on the program because it's one of the shorter ones. It's called All Aboard.
Oh, yes.
That is
yes.
Such a poignant poem.
Yeah.
You wrote that in the last couple of years?
I did. I wrote it just a couple of years ago. So, yeah. I wrote it when I was 59, and that's 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So these poems are written over the course of a number of years, just kind of gathered together?
Yes, actually, I think really like quite a long period, because I really haven't had a book since late 70s, early 80s.
Uh-huh.
So it's really like 10 or 15 years worth of work. 15 years, more like, yeah, all gathered together. But you know, some of them are pretty recent.
What was the feeling when you put out a book after that long interim?
Oh, it was a mixture. I mean, it was a mixture of real joy to get the book out, and you know, then kind of kicking myself a little and saying, "Geez, why wasn't I able to do this before? Why did it take me so long?" But mostly it was just a good feeling, and I've been very pleased with it.
When you imagine yourself being eulogized in such a vindictive way by former President Nixon,
mm-hmm.
you write your own biography in a way, and you say that you were a radical till the day you died, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
With this lifelong feeling of concern about progressive issues, what is your view of our current situation? If you could, you know, give it in a brief way, our current situation in this country, how are things looking?
Things are looking pretty grim. I think we've had, as I was saying before, we've had a president who might have done better from a left point of view and didn't, and I think that has slowed things down. And meanwhile, you know, he gets criticism from people on the right who say, "Oh, he's too liberal," which is far from the case. So I'm not pleased with the way things are at the moment, and I'm just hoping to keep up the struggle, really. And I don't have much in the way of prediction, but just keeping up the struggle is really the thing that counts, as far as I'm concerned. You just got to do it.
What are the issues that you personally are focusing on?
Well, I think racism is a big issue for me. It's so pervasive in the society, and in those of us in the majority culture, it's sort of in us, and you know, not even consciously all the time. Healthcare for everyone is a big issue for me. It's just so unfair and so unequal and unbalanced. You know, the amount of money that you have to pay for medical care and the poor quality of the care that you're going to get if you're poor. And of course, that kind of issue is got some relations to racism too, and an even larger related issue, you know, inequality of the distribution of wealth
mm-hmm.
in the country. I mean, that's a big thing.
So you think that the CEO compensation we've been reading about is somehow not fair?
Somehow not fair. I think that's a good way of putting it. Somehow not fair. Yeah, it's unreal. You know, if you really would stop and think about it, you know, and say to yourself, well, does it make any sense to have a society in which the discrepancy is so large? It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I don't know what the percentage is, but, you know, 20, 40, 50 times what somebody makes is what one of these CEO makes. It just doesn't seem rational to me.
What I find most striking is a company will lose millions of dollars and the CEO will still get 50 or 60 million in compensation.
Yeah, that's... if it was truly rational, there would be some connection there. There doesn't seem to be.
Well, Dick, I really enjoyed this book, and I'm so glad that you had time to share some of it with our listeners here in Southwest Ohio.
Well, I enjoyed it, Vic. I enjoyed talking to you, and I hope everybody listening got some pleasure out of it. And
well, whether it was
we'll
pleasure
it
or pain,
or
I'm
pain.
Sure, I'm sure it was exquisite.
Whatever they got.
The book is Ghost Radio. It's Dick Lurie's new collection of poetry. It's on the Hanging Loose Press. And you got a great plug from Denise Levertov. Have you known her for a long time?
Yes, she was my first teacher in 1964 when I was first becoming a poet. And It was through her that I met the guys where we started hanging loose, and she remained a close friend till her death a year or two ago. So, yeah, she was very important in my life.
And tell us about Abby Friedman.
Well, Abby Friedman, somebody I've been married to for the last 15, 16 years. She's a wonderful person. Best thing that ever happened to me, she's a video producer, very talented. And right now, in fact, she and I are working together on a feature-length documentary about a doo-wop group called the G-Clefs, who are still singing together after 40 years. And in fact, I'm a member of their backup band. So she and I are working together on that, and she's just a great person.
Now, did they have any songs that we would remember from the early days?
Their big hit was, their two biggest hits, one was called Ka-Ding Dong, and the other one was called I Understand.
Oh.
I understand just how you feel, something like that.
Uh-huh. Well, Dick, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Vic.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. Going back to 1999, my only interview with the poet Dick Lurie. And Dick, it took him 15 years to put out that book, Ghost Radio. He had poetry that he'd written over a 15-year period, and he's still with us, and I would love to know what kind of topical poetry he is writing these days, because he really dealt with some issues. That poem about the Cleveland Indians and the Atlanta Braves, that was a searing poem. His poetry about Richard M. Nixon, which I absolutely loved then and I still love. And wow, what an amazing guy. And somewhat controversial, as you can imagine. And Dick Lurie, if he was writing a poem about what's going on in the last week, he's probably writing about the fires in Los Angeles. And these are clearly the result of our changing climate. And it's kind of a scary thing to contemplate that we're in a position right now to help the climate, to not change so quickly, maybe cut back on these fossil fuel emissions. But we have an incoming president who's got the mantra of drill, baby, drill. He believes that climate change is a hoax. And I don't know if he's paying attention to what's going on the West Coast. He's clearly busy right now getting ready for his inauguration. But if climate change is a hoax, what's going on? Why is Los Angeles on fire? Where there's smoke, there's fire. And it's a scary time. I had an interview scheduled this week with a writer in Los Angeles. 1 hour before it was set to begin, our taping was canceled because he had to evacuate his home. He had to flee. Another writer I interviewed recently also fled his home in Los Angeles this week, and I'm sure there's more. I have four guests I'm trying to book right now who live in L.A., and it certainly complicates my life, and it really complicates theirs. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Once again, that was Dick Lurie with his book of poetry, Ghost Radio, released back in 1999. Thanks for listening to your public radio station and to programs like this one. I'm Vic McCunis.